Okay, yeah, thank you for the invitation to speak. I'm excited to be here. And when you give talks, there are certain rules, or at least unwritten rules, for what to talk about and present and what not to present. And they exist for a reason. So like a classic example is like you don't define mixed Hodge structures. Idea being that someone that has never seen that before, it's not going to be enlightening to them. Someone that knows it well, they don't need to see it. Like similarly, you're not carrying out long calculations. And these rules exist for good reason. And yet, at least today, I'm going to break the rules. And the reason I'm going to break the rules is I want to advocate for a certain computational tool, which is the Diamond Lemma, which I kind of think should just be better known. And I'll give you kind of a user's guide for just how you think about what you're doing, what you do when you do this. And that will be the first half of the talk. And then I'll move specifically to kind of algebras where this is like the subject of joint work with Travis Shedler. It's active research. And in doing so, I'm going to kind of betray some of the geometric kind of perspectives of these algebras. So I'll try to kind of say some things in words, but at least the beginning of the talk is going to be very algebraic. And so let me get started just with like an example, a motivating example here. The other thing is I don't really know people's backgrounds completely, so just interrupt me. Let me know if I say something you don't know. So V is going to be a vector space. And I'll have some multiplication on it. I won't tell you what this is yet, and we're going to tease it out. And with this data, I want to define a deformation. This is going to be some one parameter family of associative algebras. And so the parameter will be T. I'm using frac U to be suggestive. And then I'll put in my V with the multiplication. And so this is going to be defined to be the tensor algebra on V, adjoining T as my formal parameter. And then I want to set commutators. X and Y are in my vector space. This will be T times the multiplication. Okay, and then the motivating question that I'll kind of answer and we'll attack in a very general way is when is this a flat deformation? So what are some conditions I'll have to put on this multiplication? So when is this flat? People understand the question. So maybe it's goofy to say flat because it's over k brackets brackets t. And so the flat things are going to be free. I'm like asking for when this is just polynomials, which is the zero fiber when t equals zero here, adjoining t. So I'm specifically changing the multiplication here, but I can ask for a map like this as like k brackets brackets t modulus. And yet another rephrasing maybe is that I just want the dimension of the fiber at one. Everything's going to be infinite dimensional, so just a slight refinement. The Hilbert series, what I was calling it, in some variable s to just be the same Hilbert series as what's happening at the special fiber, which for the purpose of what we're doing today, it like starts with constant functions, and then there's a DMV worth of linear functions, and then there's higher order terms, and we won't need that. And so really just the very abstract question is, I have a presentation of an algebra by generators and relations, and I want to know its size. And this is where the Diamond Lemma comes in. It just really makes things nice. And so Diamond Lemma. This is, so Bergman wrote this down. this is very old, it's 1978. And he points out that some, you know, ring theorists already know this. They seem to be using it freely, but other ones don't. And they do these very tedious checks and kind of reprove it in each instance. And so, what's the philosophy? You have an algebra presented as a free algebra mod relations, so as a quotient, and you'll realize it as like a sub instead. So you'll realize a map from the full tensor algebra to A plus, kind of adding the relations back in. This will just be like as vector spaces. And the trick for realizing A is sitting inside is that you're identifying it with some set of irreducible monomials, or maybe the span of some irreducible monomials. And so, yeah, let me kind of give you the idea for what this is. So first, we'll fix an order on V. In today's talk, V will be finite dimensional, but it doesn't need to be for kind of this business. And using the ordering by path length, or by length of these monomials, I'll get an order on this tensor algebra. Yes, exactly. I'm using lexicographic order. I should write that here or something. X. And now, once I've done this, I'm only ever going to read relations. So Ri relation. I'm going to only ever read it in one direction. And so I define this little Ri will be a reduction. And what it does is it takes the leading term of the relation to just something that's strictly smaller and differs by exactly the relation. So I'm using these reductions to go smaller and smaller. If I have like A times this out in front, the A just comes along for the ride. So that's how you define it on other terms. If I have a monomial that has none of these leading terms in it, then when I apply each reduction, it's the identity. This is the thing that's reduced or irreducible. And so monomials without kind of subterms, subwords, form are reduced or irreducible. And so the span of those guys is going to be this. So now I've kind of given you guys the procedure. So let me pause and see if there's questions about this, especially if it's new. We're going to see it in a bunch of examples. That'll be the name of the game today. And so that should clarify things. Maybe I'll say kind of one more way. What I'm trying to do is define a reduction map that takes in, maybe if it's a sum of things, takes in as a sum, but takes in a monomial and it reduces it. And I just want this definition to be, I get to reduce it however I want. There's some composition of reductions that gets me to something irreducible. So this will be, and this is like some finite composition. Yeah. So great. So this is not well defined, right? And it's not well defined for two reasons. So one, I need the existence of a sequence. Existence. And yet, the way I want to do the talk today, I don't want you to worry about this first issue. In fact, I've kind of I have this finite dimensional, I have lexicographic ordering. And so every single guy will just have some, once I use the dimension of the vector space times the length of the word, that many reductions, I'll just be irreducible at that point. So basically, automatic today, but maybe like e.g., you could just kind of mess up and write down the wrong definition, where you say that x is greater than x squared, for example, and then nothing is ever reducing. So but this is not what we're doing today. The real subtlety is the other issue. So two sequences, like need to give the same irreducible expression. This is the thing I claim is kind of subtle in general.
Two sequences meaning two different orders?
So two sequences of reductions that make you irreducible. And again, we'll see some examples. Let me just kind of down here sketch that if I have like some word going, then it has leading term of some relation. Then later in it, it gets the leading term of a second one. This kind of a word poses no issue because you come along and you apply the reduction one to this. I don't know you did that. I apply reduction two here. But applying this doesn't prevent me from doing that, and vice versa. So in this setting, these two reductions just commute, and there's not really an issue. The thing that really poses an issue is when W is the product of three terms like this, the first two of which are the leading term of some relation, and the second two are the leading term of a second, where after you apply one, you can't apply the other. So this is this information is called an ambiguity for the kind of obvious reason. So this is an overlap ambiguity. Okay, and then we say such a thing is resolvable if I can just find some sequence of reductions here and some other sequence of reductions here. I don't know, I'm kind of messing up this part. Okay, fine, where I get to the same expression down here. So if I want this red map to be well-defined, I definitely need all of these overlap ambiguities to resolve. And what Bergman shows is the converse, that it suffices to check these overlap ambiguities. And if all of these resolve, then that map is well-defined. So theorem, Bergman, if every ambiguity solves, then red is well defined.
Is this the diamond or the diamond
lemma? Yeah, great. So this is completing, this was the top part, and then you're completing the diamond down like this. Yeah, so that is exactly the name. There's like confluence, other things you can give this. And let me just point out why we achieved our goal here. And so crucially, when I do this map, I'm only ever changing things by relations. This is actually precisely the kernel, and the inclusion is a section of this. And so it splits, and so yeah. So now this is us winning. Mod out by this ideal on both sides. And I'm saying this one is an isomorphism of algebras, but not giving this the same multiplication that it has sitting inside the tensor algebra. If I multiply these two in the tensor algebra and I get something that's not reduced, then I apply red again. So I'm back among irreducibles. So okay, so this was the whole theory I wanted to present. And then we'll do like three or four examples, including answering the original question. And so questions about this so far? Yeah.
What's the meaning of everything going to be resolved? Does it mean that exists those errors so that it goes to your...
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm checking overlaps. I'm checking overlaps among these leading terms. And if every single one of them has these further arrows to get to the same expression, then all the ambiguities are resolved.
So if it exists any one of, I mean, arrows?
Yeah, yeah, it means for the data of x, y, z, R1 and R2, there exists R1 prime a composition and R2 prime a composition that gets you to the same place. So basically, we already knew that they were we already know they differ by a relation by going to a higher place, but because we're only ever moving down, like we need to kind of need it to happen again. Other questions about this? This seems difficult to check. So in practice, we'll do it in some examples, and you'll basically see that the checks are actually quite small. There's kind of finitely many ambiguities to check. The thing that can happen is in trying to resolve something, it doesn't work and you have to throw in more ambiguities. And so I'll show that and kind of say yes and no to your point.
Depends a lot on what your relations
are, right? Yeah, yeah. And so let's just do the kind of the polynomials as a first example. Where am I in my notes? Okay, so example one. Yeah, so I'm just writing it as non-commutative polynomials, mod the point of the fact that they commute, and I'm picking like, so fix, there's nothing canonical about what I'm doing. I'm like choosing orderings and things. So I'm picking this, a basis, and I've indexed it so you know which ones come first. And so now what is your reductions look like this? And maybe writing the tensor each time will be painstaking, so I won't. There, I dropped it there. So great. So they're just reordering things. So it's very easy in this case to say what the irreducible things are, the guys that can't be made smaller by applying reductions. That's the span of things that are already in order. So x1, a1, x2, a2. And then I claim if the Diamond Lemma works out here, that this is giving us a basis for commutative polynomials. And so what do we have to check? We have to check the overlaps. And so I'm going to do something a little perverse. I'm actually going to check it here, because then when we go to deform it, it will actually kind of just be a little bit easier to see. But here it's very clear. I give you three terms that are out of order. And then you just you order them. I'm gonna have to write this a bunch of times, so I'll drop the indices, but we have z being greater than y greater than x, and you have this is what all of your overlap ambiguities look like. And the point is I can make two choices about switching these or switching these. And if I do it the first way, like, I now have to kind of pay attention to how I did this. But let me switch first there. I pick up the commutator.
Is there something about what have you switched?
I'm doing it all at once, but I'm basically, I'm applying all of the reductions, but we when when I add in all these terms, you'll see it's the same. Here, yeah, let me finish writing here, and then it'll make more sense. So like this had xyz, then xyz was here, but now I have a yxz term, so I'm picking it up there. Anyways, this is a calculation.
What was the first reduction you did in this case? Was the first reduction that you saw
with yx? I kind of worked backwards from the end, so I cheated. But yeah, maybe the first reduction, let's say, was this one. So I swapped y and z. Yeah, sorry about this presentation. I guess this is the first guy I did. Then this was the second, and then that was the third. Okay. And the other way I could have done it would produce all the exact same terms, except the z will kind of be on this side. Anyways, this calculation comes up in different guises all the time, and so I imagine a lot of you guys have done it. And the difference between these two is saying that, like, I'm switching notation now to kind of a bracket notation, saying that, like, bracket of x with y bracketed with z minus bracket of y bracketed with x, z minus, these are all pluses, bracket. Yeah, I'm just saying that this is zero, and applying the kind of anti-commutativity twice here, you see that this is exactly just the Jacobi identity. But the bracket here is just zero, so it's goofy. The place it's going to come into play is that we're deforming this bracket exactly to this mu term, right? And so, maybe I should just say, yes, this one is an isomorphism, perfectly good. And now the still not difficult, but maybe less obvious is this . So this is a quadratic part of the relations. This is linear. Except if x is actually equal to y, then the relation is just killing this part. So if I want this deformation to be flat, so for flatness, the first thing I'm going to need is that, like, this reduction that takes mu xx to 0, I need that this part was already 0, so mu alternating. Do people see that if mu is not alternating, then the image of mu xx is something that gets killed? It's in the vector space itself. And so it would lessen this dimension, make it smaller. And then the other thing is the thing I've written up here, now just with mu's replaced everywhere. When you're looking at these overlap ambiguities, you kind of get that mu has to satisfy Jacobi. But if both of those things happen, kind of this same basis is now still a basis. And the reason I only need to check these things is the Diamond Lemma. So there's more complicated expressions that are all kind of dealt with just looking at cubic terms. And so the upshot is that this data was a Lie algebra. And there's various ways that maybe you think about this calculation. And so the fiber one, this universal enveloping algebra, has basis x1, a1, xd, ad. You can also say it as the kind of the whole family was being flat. It's a flat deformation. Or you can say the associated graded of the universal enveloping is symmetric. Right, and so this is the PBW theorem. I've given you what I think is the kind of the shortest proof, but maybe it's kind of algebraic and gross, and it's got kind of the converse part to it as well. Okay, so questions about this. So we've answered the question, and the general goal is going to be to use this to kind of answer, to figure out structures of kind of other algebras.
Okay.
Yeah.
Suppose you have a quadratic relation. Is there any clear statement you can make if one will satisfy?
If I have, you're saying I have only quadratic relations.
Because you need a sim 2V. The commutator is in sim 2V.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Let me pass on that because I haven't thought about it. But basically. Yeah, I'm kind of exploiting the fact that then this is kind of always a smaller piece for me right now. And so, yeah, my guess is it's a little bit of a minefield. Ironically, I maybe will give a partial answer in that setting. So let's get there. I'm also going to, I'll do a little reading for you guys. So Ben Elias has a paper from this year, which is a diamond lemma for Heckatype algebras. And he has this remark that, like, I thought was funny or worth reading. He says, if you're defining an algebra by generators and relations, it's good practice to check overlap ambiguities, see if they're resolvable, even if you're not going to use any kind of diamond lemma. And so he goes on to say, when I referee a paper, I typically check the first few overlap ambiguities. You might be surprised how many significant errors I found this way. And now he starts pleading with the reader, and he's like, be responsible, check your ambiguities. And so I thought this is like a funny little remark. But yeah, this technique is still like, yeah, it's very, I think it's kind of very prevalent in active research. How am I doing on time? Okay. Okay. So let me give, I'm going to do a quick illustration in that something happened in these examples that's a little bit atypical. And so example three, this one was just constructed from my head. I don't think there's much geometry here, but I'm ordering how I said I was going to order, like this. And I need to read each of these relations as a reduction. And so x squared goes to 0, zy goes to 0, and then yx goes to xy. And here's like two different ambiguities. And okay. In this one, if I apply R1, I get 0. And then when I apply R3, it looks momentarily like I'm preventing myself from doing the relation, but then I just apply it again. And so this one resolves. With this one, though, if I apply what am I doing here? If I apply R2, I get 0. And if I switch the order instead, I get ZXY. So this is typical if you're doing calculations in this business. You get something not resolving like this. And then what you do is you throw in another reduction that gives priority to one of these over the other. Takes the bigger one to the smaller one. So now I have an R4 that finishes it for me. And in doing so, I've created another overlap, ZXYX. Is that? Yeah. And the thing that saves me here is that when you reorder and you get ZX squared Y, well, then X squared is 0. in this algebra with R1, but you could imagine just toying with this example and not allowing for that. And then the issue here is your two reductions are working against each other. One of them is preventing you from applying the other one. In this setting, you'll need to have infinitely many reductions for each term z, x to the n, y. And if you'd like, the failure was that you weren't, this term is exactly, this example is defined where x is your buffer that sits between z and y and doesn't let you use that relation. And so you should have ordered it differently. If you order z less than y less than x here, then there's no more issue with terms like this. The y comes over and cancels with the z. So this is maybe a more typical example where your relations didn't give you every reduction you needed. You had to add another one. You got more ambiguities than they resolved.
Also, I think the relation changes
that. But notice I haven't added a relation here. That's actually a really important point. I've added a reduction that continues to enforce the same relations as before. Yeah, thanks for that. Other questions kind of while I erase this part of the board? So we're going to move to the algebras of study today now. So example four. So this is a deformation of just when it's zero. And so when is this flat? I wrote these algebras here on the side as good reference. I think depending on where you are in the room, you can't read these. The point is you take a path algebra of a doubled quiver, you mod out by this single relation that's quadratic, then with a constant term. The constant term is the thing I'm thinking of as the deformation. And then the geometric origin is that the representations of this doubled quiver that descend to this quotient, they live in the fiber of lambda of the moment map. And so maybe hopefully this is something you guys care about. So is a deformation, when is this flat? And so example 4a, let's just take Q to be small, like the A2 quiver. And so in this case, we have this single relation. Let me just write it here. The relation is A star A minus A star A minus. Right, because my quiver, I should have drawn it, has vertex 1, vertex 2, A, and A star. And so, yeah, so I've doubled the quiver, adding this arrow back. This is my relation. You should view these relations for pre-projective algebras as one at each different vertex. And so really, it's like you have multiplying by the idempotent at 1. You have like A star. And then you similarly have and so the reductions, I always miss this minus sign. Okay, so the reductions take this to lambda 1, E1. Goes to minus lambda 2, E2. And now you guys see what the overlaps are. They'll both tell you the same information, A star A, and the other one. The point being, if you use one here, you get lambda 1a. If you use the second one, you get minus lambda 2a. And so so either these were actually the same, lambda 1 plus lambda 2 is 0, or actually a was 0 in this algebra, and the whole algebra kind of degenerates to the 0 algebra. And so these things you're trying to define in this A2 case, generically it's 0. And then just on this particular hyperplane, you get a flat deformation. OK? And now I want to contrast this with what happens if you do A2 tilde, where you have a cycle. So example 4b. So like A, B, C. And I want to view the dual arrows as being bigger or something, but in any case, the relations I get at each vertex look like here, when I leave and come back this way, minus leaving and coming back that way, gives me lambda 1, and then similarly. And so what are the overlaps in this case? Exactly, there are none. So here there's no overlaps. So it's telling you something completely different than over there. I'm now just always freely using this diamond lemma and saying there's not more to check. The basis doesn't depend. On the lambda i's, and you can just, maybe I won't do it in a precise way, but you can just say what the basis is. It's like you're not allowed to go, no going clockwise after you've gone counterclockwise. So this is a talk, it's not a precise description, but things like A, B, C are in there, or like C star, B star, A star, or A, A star, but I'm disallowing kind of these are the things I'm viewing as my leading terms. I'm not allowing them on my basis. And so the diamond lemma knows no geometry, it doesn't know about any of that stuff, and yet it produces like the answers that you could get maybe from more geometric methods in these two examples. And I want to also point out that these examples are illustrating exactly what happens in the Dinkin case and the non-Dinkin case. So in general, for Dinkin, you need the sum of these lambda i's to be zero to have any chance of being a flat deformation. And then in the extended Dinkin case, for example, it always is flat, and same thing in the other cases. It's always flat. And so I haven't proven it for you, but that was supposed to be in words, the whole answer.
Sorry.
Yeah.
See, you explain what happens in Dinkin and extended Dinkin, but if you take a generic Weber, which isn't either.
Yeah. So in that case, yeah, in that case, it's more like this one. And so this is something I was maybe going to say later as part of like a bootstrapping, but so with Travis, we prove results maybe about this multiplicative guy, and we're following this argument of Edinghoff and Oy that I think is quite interesting, where they prove results about kind of, you know, generic, not Dinkin, not extended Dinkin, using information about extended Dinkin. And so induction, I'll just do like half a board with this because I think it's kind of a nice idea, but it's somewhat algebraic. So you have Q not Dinkin, and that means that it contains some extended Dinkin sitting inside, because the only way it's not Dinkin is if it's kind of too big, it's bigger. And so I'll get a picture going where the extended Dinkin is this piece, and then you have some arrows that are leaving or coming from the extended Dinkin part. And then you have some rest of your quiver that can do really whatever you want. That's enough. Okay. And the point is, at the level of path algebras, the path algebra of this guy sitting inside is a subalgebra of the path algebra of the whole thing. At the level of preprojective algebras, it's just a subquotient. By adding an arrow like this, I've changed the relation now at this vertex to have a piece here. And the correction is that you filter the preprojective algebra of the whole thing using the red arrows. And so the degree zero filtered piece, this is a descending filtration, is everything. And then the degree one piece uses one of the red arrows. Has at least one red arrow, and then et cetera. And in doing so, you're exactly correcting for the issue you have in changing this relation, because the other pieces now, the contribution of the red arrows, is in this next filtered piece. And so on the level of associated graded, you get back the pre-projective algebra for the extended Dinkin sitting inside with some other term. So pads can be written as things in here plus in another guy. And this is, again, a pre-projective algebra for the rest. But you've spoiled the relations now that were here at the extended, at these vertices that were in the extended Dinkin part. And so this is what's called a partial pre-projective algebra, where you just turn off the relations there. And so the name of the game for general quivers is to understand these partial pre-projective algebras and to know them pretty well here, where they have more kind of geometric origin, coming from Mukai correspondence. They have relations to their non-commutative resolutions of Kleinian singularities. Okay, so that's kind of, that's the more general story. And it lets you recover a lot of results that you have for extended Dinkin. Okay, so now, let me, while I'm erasing, I just did this one. I don't need this first board. Let me just give a quick incomplete oral history of multiplicative pre-projective algebras. So Crawley, Bovey, and Shaw defined them, and they were interested in encoding these solutions of the Deline-Simpson problem. So whatever that is, it's a problem in linear algebra. And these solutions were exactly irreducible representations of the deformed pre-projective algebra. They were irreducible representations of this multiplicative pre-projective algebra. Then Vandenberg realized the connection to geometry, where the relation can be viewed as some kind of group-valued moment map. And so it's kind of the group-valued analog of the usual pre-projective algebra. Yamakawa defined multiplicative quiver varieties, and there's been other work in that direction. So like their pure cohomology was computed by McGurdy Nevins. David Jordan writes down quantized versions. Then in another direction in geometry, so Ed Gula Keeley were computing Fukaya categories of plumbed cotangent bundles, and these algebras arose. And then in a similar, or maybe in a mirror symmetric way, Bezra, Kovnikov, and Kapranov have this paper where they're looking at microlocal sheaves, on chains of P1s. And so, these are really kind of in geometry now. And Ben Webster also has a paper with Ben Gamage and Michael McBreen, and they're doing homological mirror symmetry for hypertoric varieties. And this kind of comes up just as a special case in much the same vein as it came up in the other ways. And so, usually you write stuff down when you're giving a talk. But let me give a quick summary of the algebraic results, and then I'll explain how to use kind of Diamond Lemma to get at them. Okay. I just did erase that. Maybe I'll put it here because it's the center of the board. So this is a theorem with Travis Shedler, and then I'll use red to denote what's a conjecture, kind of just as one statement. And so, theorem. So if Q contains a cycle, basically, we We figure out everything explicitly in the cycle case using the diamond lemma and then use this induction argument, but modified to the multiplicative setting. And it's really an artifact of the proof that it has to be Q containing a cycle. It's not really what you want to write or what you want to prove. And so the conjecture would be that really this should just work for Q non-Dinkin. That's kind of the more reasonable expectation. And then what are the statements? So this is a two Calabi-Yau algebra. And if the containment of the cycle is some strict thing, then the Calabi-Yau structure is unique. So then Calabi-Yau structure. The idea being I have little freedom in Calabi-Yau structures to begin with. They're just, it's like a torsor for invertible elements of the center. And giving a description like this means that the center is going to be small, just scalars of the identity. And then it doesn't get better when I take off the associated gradient. And so the center in kind of the non-extended Dinkin, non-Dinkin cases is just scalars. There is a DG version of this, which I can go into more detail after, but I'm a little low on time. And so we show that this is formal, and it has homology, the usual guy, but just in degree zero. So kind of the formality is coming for free with the homology just sitting in degree zero. And then this one's just like a more algebraic result. We show that this is a prime ring. In the case of the cycle itself, when Q is set equal to 1, then we get also that this is a non-commutative resolution, even crepant, over its center. And the center looks a little bit like what the Kleinian singularities look like. I guess it's like formally locally the same. You get this like z to the n plus 1 plus xy plus xyz. So sorry, this is low on the board now, but here it differs from just what the statement would be for the usual pre-projective algebra by this 1 plus z term. And if I'm near the origin, which is where the unique singularity is here, then that's basically like 1. And so here's a summary of results and kind of continuing in red with what the conjecture should be. It would just be if it strictly contains its extended Dinkin, then it should be unique. This one should go through the exact same. It should still be prime. The center should be different, but it will still be a non-commutative resolution. Okay, so actually, yeah. So questions about these statements? I haven't really set you up where I've defined all this. Carefully.
What's the relationship between spec of the center and the quiver variety?
Between spec, so the.
The one is not a big center. Or is
it? Yeah. Sorry. So if you have this guy and you have an extended Dinkin, then what's the best way to say this? Shoot. This is the best way to say it. You have a projection map if I take like the extended vertex like this, where I just look at things starting and ending there. And if I restrict to the center, I get an isomorphism. It's not that elements of the center are literally this, they're just isomorphic sitting inside. Yeah, and so we're proving an analogous thing with in the multiplicative case. Yeah, and so these are big, they're like full dimensional centers. And it's just you can't deform for this statement. Okay. Let's do. Okay, maybe this will kind of round things out nicely for where I am now in the talk. So these statements are not about Dink and Quivers, and so they haven't been left out just like as an afterthought. It's for a reason. If we go back to the A2 case, say, I never walked over here and explained this definition. So before we had a commutator equaling, you know, some deformed guy, and now we have the multiplicative version, one plus these guys, you take a product of all of them, you have to choose some ordering to take the product. And here we need to adjoin inverses. And so these terms don't exist necessarily in the path algebra, you have to add them in. And when you're in the Dinkin case, they were actually already there. And so so it's not a big deal. But what's the relation here? It's something like 1 plus A star is Q1 plus Q2. So I've moved the inverse over to the other side. And if you do kind of E1 times it, you get this. And if you do the other one, E2 times it, you get this. And now you can play the same game as what we did for the additive one, where you're looking at, say, this ambiguity. And just like before, it resolving to the same thing is Q1 minus 1 equaling, well, Q2 minus 1 over Q2. Yeah. Sorry, with like a minus sign. And so multiply this through and subtract out, you get the condition that the product of these things have to be 1, the analogous condition to the sum being 0. And so just like for the additive case, there's kind of generically these are 0, and then you have this place where they're not. And then also, like in the additive case, once we go to the cycle, we'll get no conditions. Where did I put? Eraser. So maybe I'll quickly show that and then call it. This is important to say. So why am I using this like very archaic algebraic technique? The techniques you would want to use, the kinds of things that people had used before for pre-projective algebras, they use things like the causality that rely on the quadratic relations. They use extra structure that you have in that setting. Here, the relations are not quadratic. You pick up higher order terms. And so a lot of what kind of was available in that setting kind of isn't available here. And let me just, maybe I'll just end with this, with the cycle case. So. Again, just like A, B, and C. And the relations look like this with the other ones, but you can sum all of the relations and kind of write everything as a single relation, where alpha is the sum, A plus B, C. And then the reductions you have in this case, there's more you have to deal with. I want to take terms like this and rewrite them. But again, this is kind of just a choice I'm making. So they have the piece in the relation, minus 1. And then I also need ones that enforce the relations. So I'll just write in words, inverse reduction. And then I also need ones that push the inverses to the front. And so like if I have something like this, it's the same as pulling it out the other way. And I can multiply kind of by the inverses on both sides. And so what I'm trying to get at is you can always pull the inverses to the front and then cancel them, and you end up getting a basis that's just in these inverses to any power, so to n, and then you can have, that's supposed to be an alpha, then alpha to the m. And then you can also do this with alpha star in the way the reductions are set up. And so n is an integer, m is a natural number. And so once you get this explicit basis, then you can start kind of looking at this resolution that's in Crawley, Bowman, and Shaw. It's a proposed resolution, but they kind of don't prove that the first map is injective. You can prove this, so you get kind of the two-dimensionality of it. You can start proving statements about the center. You can prove it's prime. And so you get a lot of, like, maybe potentially more geometric things for free once you kind of just run this procedure, get this explicit basis, you really have your hands on it. And so that was kind of the idea I wanted to get across today, and thanks for listening.
How you should
think about spec of the center? Oh, in the multiplicative or in the additive?
I mean, either one.
Yeah. So.
Because like every quiver variety should have a map to that, where you look at the representation and look at how the center acts on it, right?
Yeah. So let me. Yeah. Sorry. I'm trying to think about what the best thing to say is, but maybe. Let me do this. So if you have, I don't know, let's do this kind of cycle case again. And let me just start cherry picking elements in the center. So you have the unit, and then you have things like AA star plus BB star plus CC star. You have like sorry, I realized that this wasn't a good kind of uniform approach, but you have these kind of three guys. So as Z, you have a short cycle. As X, you have one that goes all the way around. And then that's why you have going around the other way. And then the relation says that if I do this one and then this one, I get three copies of that. And the relations also crucially say that this is commutative. And so my claim is that this is your center in this setting, and that this is exactly this Kleinian singularity.
Which is also quiver.
Which is also a quiver variety of that type. How do you mean, in the sense that?
What do I mean? I mean, if I look at the all ones dimension vector.
Okay. And you're not framing anything for this.
Well, I mean, okay, if you're not framing, you have to be a little bit careful. I mean, the statement that's on the nose is if you like put in the framing.
Okay.
But like the framing is one dimensional, so.
Oh yeah, yeah, I see.
Doing very much.
Yeah.
That, right. Like.
Yeah.
You know, somehow being unframed just means you have some extra C star floating around.
Yeah. Yeah, I see.
Unnecessarily.
Yeah. Let's maybe like let the poor people go, because I've been torturing them for now, and we should talk about this.
Okay.
I can. Other questions? No. Okay. Yeah.